amplifying those successes throughout the organization. By amplifying the successful ideas and solutions created by members of our teams, leaders show how relinquishing control, empowering the team, and listening benefit the organization as a whole. They advance the mission of the organization by making positive examples of the kinds of ideas and actions that achieve results necessary for optimum, enduring, and sustainable success. Good leaders share credit and accept blame. Good leaders don't simply proclaim an interest in initiative and innovation, but articulate how much risk they are willing to take to enable initiative and innovation. They define the white lines on the road they expect their subordinates to travel. Even more important than establishing limits, they champion success. General Dempsey absolutely embraced the differences among the armed services during his time as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He applauded their individual cultures and traditions, while at the same time working diligently to integrate them into the broader missions of the joint force. He valued diverse thinking from senior military leaders who saw America's security and its vulnerabilities and opportunities through different lenses. There was always a bit of friction as this group of very senior, very experienced leaders expressed themselves during weekly meetings, but he saw it as his job, as the senior leader among them, to ensure that it was creative friction. Not surprisingly, there were times when one service or another would outperform the others. In those times, Dempsey would gather the service chiefs to discuss the issues. He would amplify successes and encourage these highly competitive and accomplished senior leaders to align their efforts. The more they listened to one another, the more they learned from one another, and the more likely it became that they would amplify one another's efforts. Generally, when facing a problem, the Joint Chiefs of Staff would together establish objectives for solving it collectively. Then, with the authorities inherent within the services, each service would set about the task of accomplishing those objectives. There were plenty of opportunities to compare outcomes. In one six-month period of 2014, General Dempsey recalls reviewing plans for care of the wounded, efforts to reduce suicide, prevention of sexual assault, and integration of women into jobs previously closed to them. Each of these issues, and many more, posed challenges of implementation. In resolving these challenges, the Joint Chiefs never allowed themselves to throw up the shield of difference among the services. They amplified what they could learn from one another. When a leader amplifies the successes of the members of his organization at all levels of responsibility, he provides more than a teaching moment to his team about what success looks like. It is not only a pat on the back for the individual whose success is amplified, it's a memory, and it's one that matters. It's an action taken to further the mission of the team. It has helped to reinforce a sense of belonging and demonstrate the leader's willingness to relinquish control. All of these principles and instincts are what this new leadership theory deems necessary for companies and countries to thrive in the new environment. Through constant reinforcement of these principles and ongoing development of these instincts, leaders can develop teams and organizations that will build and sustain their power, not through control, but by radical inclusion. Part 4. In Inclusion, We Trust. Chapter 13. Trust Earned Early and Often. Digital echoes are loud. Trust lowers the volume. On June 5, 1974, General Dempsey was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army following his graduation from West Point. As part of the ritual of commissioning, each new officer selects an enlisted soldier to render the first salute. Most often, it is someone who has been an important part of the new officer's development. Dempsey chose Sergeant Major Bernie Henderson. Bernie Henderson was the senior armor non-commissioned officer in the Department of Military Instruction. Because Dempsey had known since his sophomore year that he wanted to become an armor officer, Henderson had become a mentor to him. Sergeant Major Henderson was a superb leader, A Vietnam veteran with several decades of military experience, he was a great listener, a patient teacher, and a man of uncompromising principles. Though Dempsey was a young man, not yet 21 years old when he first met the sergeant major, Henderson treated him with genuine respect. He also made sure Dempsey understood the important advisory role of the non-commissioned officer in our Army. As Dempsey's oath of commissioning was read and his mother and father pinned on his second lieutenant insignia, he turned to see Sergeant Major Henderson approaching from his right. Henderson snapped off a crisp salute and proclaimed, "Welcome to the regular Army, Lieutenant Dempsey." As is the custom, Dempsey returned his salute and thanked him for his part in Dempsey's becoming an officer. In return for the first salute, officers are expected to give the non-commissioned officer a silver dollar. In 1974, silver dollars had become scarce, so most of Dempsey's classmates had elected to hand the non-commissioned officer a signed dollar bill instead. Dempsey reached in his pocket and felt around for the dollar bill he had placed there an hour earlier. He found it and handed it to Sergeant Major Henderson. Henderson smiled and said, "I'll send this back to you when you become a general." Dempsey chuckled and told him that if that was the case, he'd never see that dollar again. Henderson told him not to worry about making general, but simply to earn the trust of his soldiers, as Dempsey had earned his trust. It was an emotional moment as Henderson turned and walked away. To his great regret, Dempsey lost track of Henderson. He would hear from him from time to time, but most of Dempsey's early career was spent in Germany, and Henderson had retired in Maryland. The years passed, and in 2001, Dempsey became a brigadier general. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton, presided over a nice ceremony in the Pentagon. For just a brief moment, as the ceremony concluded and Dempsey was announced as Brigadier General Martin Dempsey, he thought of Sergeant Major Henderson's prediction. In June 2014, Dempsey reached 40 years of commissioned service in the Army. His classmates were planning a reunion for the fall, so the exact day passed without fanfare. But later in June, a package arrived at Dempsey's quarters. He was more than surprised to see on the return address that it was sent by one Sergeant Major, retired, Bernie Henderson. Inside the package was a framed $1 bill with Dempsey's signature on it. The note that accompanied it said, "I told you I would return this to you when you made general. Sorry it took so long. Bernie Henderson." It brought Dempsey to tears. That framed dollar now sits on his desk to remind him of how one person's trust in another can be so empowering. 9 months before Dempsey was to retire as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in January 2015, he was told that Vice President Biden, who was scheduled to give the commencement address at West Point that year, wanted to offer that honor to him. This was unusual. Commencement addresses at the four service academies are normally given by the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and the service secretaries, but Dempsey immediately accepted and thanked the vice president. It was a very nice gesture by a very thoughtful leader. Of course, once Dempsey accepted the offer, he began to feel anxious about the task. Like many college graduates, he couldn't even remember who had given the commencement address at his graduation. He wanted to leave these graduates something to remember. January and February ticked by, and Dempsey still hadn't decided how he would approach the speech. He was rarely nervous about public speaking. This was the exception. One evening in early March, Dempsey walked past the bookcase where Bernie Henderson's framed $1 bill was displayed. In that moment, he knew what he would do. The next day, he asked Deeney for $1,100. Dempsey almost never carried more cash than he needed for an occasional haircut. So she asked what it was for, he told her. As he walked into Mitchie Stadium in May 2015 for West Point's graduation ceremony, his heart was racing. Just over 1,000 eager seniors turned to watch their fellow West Pointer, a four-star general and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, mount the stage. It was to these young men and women that Dempsey would soon turn over the reins of America's armed forces when his time was done. After the introductions and invocations, it was Dempsey's turn to speak. He warmed them up with a little graduation karaoke, including a verse of Sinatra's New York, New York. And then, in the culmination of a 12-minute commencement address, he told them that all they needed to remember about his time with them on that day were these three words: I trust you. As they proudly marched across the stage to receive their diplomas, Dempsey handed each of them a crisp, new $1 bill. It probably wasn't until they had returned to their seats that they noticed he had signed each bill. Sergeant Major Henderson would have approved. Henderson knew, Dempsey learned, and these new officers would soon find out that the essence of leadership is building trust. With this book, we provide leaders with a theory to help them prevail in what has become a very challenging leadership environment. A theory that calls upon us to emphasize where we converge, not where we diverge, to emphasize inclusion. Through the principles and instincts provided here, leaders will develop a preference for inclusion over power. As we've made clear, we advocate inclusion because of its pragmatic advantages. Inclusion leads to greater knowledge for leaders and organizations about the nature of the problems we face and the ways in which we may solve them. We strongly believe that inclusion yields better outcomes for countries, more affordable outcomes for companies, and more enduring outcomes for military operations. Though he ended up chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with an instinct for inclusion, General Dempsey says that his instinct was developed long before, in Central Europe, in the Mojave Desert, and in the Middle East. The platoon is a young Army officer's first leadership test. In 1974, 22-year-old Dempsey's platoon of 45 soldiers was tasked with patrolling the border between West Germany and Czechoslovakia. Though it's just a distant memory now, Dempsey recalls that border as the line of demarcation between the Warsaw Pact, led by the Soviet Union, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States. The platoon patrolled mounted in jeeps and in armored vehicles. They lived in austere, remote border camps filled with Quonset huts surrounded by chain-link fence and barbed wire. Their tour of duty was for 30 days at a time, two or three times a year. The rest of the year they trained for their mission at their caserne, some 60 kilometers to the west. Generally, groups of two or three vehicles with 6 to 8 soldiers would patrol around the clock over a linear distance of 7 to 10 kilometers. In the days before readily available satellite imagery and full-motion video feeds from remotely piloted aircraft, they were the eyes and ears of senior military officers and civilian officials in places like Nuremberg, Frankfurt, and Bonn. In such circumstances, individuals learn to trust one another. No one could possibly be everywhere and see everything, and so they relied on one another to understand the mission, to be vigilant, to be responsive in reporting back on events during the patrol, and to adapt when circumstances changed. In these circumstances, everyone had to contribute. Everyone had to be included. Initially, Dempsey had concluded that he could rely on some, but not all, of the 45 soldiers under his command. There were significant drug and racial problems in the Army in 1974, and Dempsey's platoon was no exception. When he first met the platoon, they were fragmented by race, divided into those who used drugs and those who didn't, those who liked one kind of music and those who preferred another, almost any excuse to be exclusionary. General Dempsey doesn't recall the exact day when he decided that developing and exhibiting an instinct for inclusion was the only way to bring the unit together and, in so doing, accomplish the mission. It might have happened on a makeshift basketball court, or around a foosball table in the mess hall, or in the motor pool while struggling to figure out how to change impossibly heavy sections of track on an armored vehicle in a foot of mud. However it happened, it worked. Dempsey got those 45 soldiers to work together on something, and then on something else, and eventually on everything. And he did it by making sure that he valued the contributions of each of them as individuals first, and then as part of the team. Some of them eventually got thrown out of the army, a few for repeated drug offenses, one or two for multiple acts of disobedience or absence, one for a bar fight back near their home station, but not for how they interacted with the team. When Dempsey had them together, focused on some common purpose and understanding that they all mattered, they were a very special group. It was with this group that Dempsey first recognized the power of inclusion. In October 1997, Dempsey took his cavalry regiment to the Mojave Desert to be tested. They were 5,200 strong. Like his cavalry platoon of 1974, they were the eyes and ears of more senior officers. In this case, the leaders of an armored corps that, when fully arrayed on the battlefield, numbered more than 50,000. The cavalry regiment is usually out front, harvesting information, sometimes fighting for information, and always shaping the battlefield for the remainder of the corps as it moves behind them. The test in the Mojave Desert was a hard one against a world-class opposing force on its home court, in remarkably harsh desert conditions. The Army wanted the scrimmage to be harder than the game, and the Mojave Desert was the perfect place for that. To accomplish its mission, the cavalry regiment spread out. It can operate 30 to 50 kilometers across in an advance, or stretch 100 kilometers along a linear boundary in a defense. The cavalry regiment is an interesting organizational design because it combines most of the Army's occupational specialties into a single organization. Scouts to find the enemy, tankers to destroy it at short range, artillerymen to suppress it at long distance, aviators to dominate from the air, engineers to improve mobility, air defenders to protect the skies above, and logisticians to keep supplies and equipment at the ready. In such an organization, parochialisms are natural. Soldiers in each specialty argue that their contribution is the most indispensable. Some of the competition is healthy and productive. Some can be unproductive. The challenge is to convince 5,200 soldiers that together they can be greater than the sum of their individual parts. The familiar leadership challenge of developing a sense of inclusion. In this case, the answer was to focus on the core mission. Dempsey found a memorable way of describing it and then frequently reinforced the message. He told the men and women of the regiment and their leaders, "We are all scouts." For the year preceding the test in the desert, he visited training ranges, motor pools, dining facilities, and barracks. At each stop, Dempsey asked soldiers, "What do you do in this regiment?" Initially, they would reply, "I'm a mechanic," or "I'm a cook," or "I'm a clerk." "Wrong," Dempsey would reply, "you're a scout." And then he would explain why. Whether on the front lines or in the rear, whether driving a tank or a fuel truck, whether ensuring communications or food supply, whether a private or a colonel, they all became scouts. Everyone became aware, vigilant, and committed to creating a shared understanding of what was happening on the battlefield. 5,200 sets of eyes and ears. Everyone included, everyone contributing. It worked. They passed the test. There were other keys to their success, but developing a sense of inclusion was the necessary start to it all. 6 years later, Dempsey found himself in command of the Army's 1st Armored Division with 32,000 soldiers in Baghdad. The stakes and the risks were higher, but the leadership challenge the same. The U.S. Army and its sister services are the preeminent leader development institutions in the land. They have to be. They train centralized, but operate decentralized. They face opponents who don't just want to gain an advantage over them, but want to drive them from the battlefield, opponents who are determined and who are adaptable. The soldiers must trust one another. Soldiers will willingly put themselves in harm's way only if they trust the man or woman to their left and right, the medic who accompanies them, the pilots who fly over them, and the leaders who direct them. Absent trust, a military unit can accomplish little. With it, the unit can accomplish almost anything. Trust is built over time. It begins with inclusion. When Dempsey arrived in Baghdad, what had changed since his days patrolling the border in Germany was the degree of decentralization and the transparency that existed in units big and small. In some ways, Dempsey says, these things make inclusion easier. In other ways, they make it harder. Baghdad is a city of just over 700 square kilometers, physically divided by a river, but divided far more fundamentally by ethnic, tribal, and religious rivalries. The task for Dempsey and his 32,000 soldiers was to establish a safe and secure environment in which Iraq's fledgling political leaders could reestablish control of their capital city and country. That task remains even today a work in progress, but not for lack of effort and sacrifice by America's men and women in uniform. Based on Baghdad's ethnic and religious fault lines, the city was divided into five sectors. A colonel with approximately 5,000 soldiers was responsible for each sector. Each colonel's responsibilities included regaining the confidence of the population, helping to reestablish basic services, fighting insurgent forces, mentoring new Iraqi government leaders, and building a new Iraqi security force. This time inclusion was accomplished by agreeing upon and monitoring a common set of metrics to measure progress toward these very complex objectives. These metrics provided the agenda for Dempsey's meetings with his colonels and the common vocabulary for their discussions. They knew that each of the multiple responsibilities had to be achieved, and that progress would be most effective if they were achieved in parallel. The group met frequently to share best practices, while also acknowledging that each sector provided its own particular challenges. Inclusion was achieved across the 32,000 soldiers of the 1st Armored Division by establishing a common commitment to learning, listening, amplifying, and then adapting. The more complex the environment became, the more Dempsey encouraged individuals at every level to simply seek to positively influence it. In that way, everyone felt ownership and inclusion in a very important, very dynamic, and very unpredictable mission. Whether leading 5,000, or 30,000 soldiers, the need to establish an environment of inclusion persisted. General Dempsey ended his career 41 years after it had begun. In the last 5 years, he was a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, first as Chief of Staff of the Army, and finally as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He had started with 45 soldiers, and ended his career leading almost 2 million men and women of all the military services, active, guard, and reserve. The scope and scale of the challenge had definitely changed, but the key to success had not. When the Joint Chiefs, Chairman, Vice Chairman, Army, Navy, Air Force and Marines, and National Guard worked together, when they felt as though they were included in the decisions at the highest level of the Department of Defense, decisions were better. With greater ownership, their implementation was much more effective. As chairman, General Dempsey was also responsible for maintaining a peer-to-peer relationship with America's 53 allies and partners across the globe. America is blessed that it can and does dominate militarily when and where it chooses to do so. As a direct consequence of our dominant military power, we must demonstrate to our allies and partners that we value their contributions and understand their unique needs in our relationship. Stated another way, if we are to maintain our relationships, we need to embrace and manifest an instinct for inclusion. It simply can't be otherwise. The stronger partner in the relationship bears more of the responsibility for sustaining and enhancing the relationship. That is true in individual relationships, and it is true in the relationships among nation states. Following World War II, America made the deliberate decision to base our own national security on a carefully crafted system of alliances and partnerships. It has stood the test of time, kept us safe, and guaranteed a global order favorable to our interests. If that system is to be preserved, time, energy, and resources must continue to be invested in sustaining the inclusion necessary for it to be effective. Today, General Dempsey teaches leadership at Duke University. One of the leadership attributes he highlights in his discussions with students is sense-making. That is, it is the responsibility of leaders at all levels to make sense of what's going on for their employees or, in the case of the military, for their junior leaders. In 45 years in uniform, General Dempsey experienced his fair share of both successes and failures. Generally, success came when everyone involved understood the task, the opportunities, and the limitations. Failures were the result of a lack of understanding, missed opportunity, and an inability to recognize limitations. Inclusion unlocks understanding and opportunity. Inclusion is the elixir against uncertainty and misunderstanding. It's as simple as that. We remind our readers and listeners that the principles and instincts that support the leadership theory described in this book are effective only when utilized as a set supporting one another. Each is necessary, but none is sufficient alone. We also remind our reader listeners that the principles and instincts will always benefit from repetition, re-emphasis, and reinforcement. Successful leaders will approach each day with the mindset that every move and decision be made with the principles and instincts in mind. We urge each of you as leaders to embrace inclusion as what is needed to move forward in the context of a changing world, and to pass this message along to your team members and fellow leaders. The importance of the message goes beyond one of successful leadership. We believe that what pulls us apart today, whether in business, the military, or politics, is exclusion. Unless leaders pay attention to inclusion, they will begin to lose their competitive advantage. We must become more attuned to the issue of belonging, develop a bias for action, learn to relinquish control when we feel power slipping, and thus cultivate an environment of inclusiveness within our teams, organizations, communities, and countries. As we face our problems, leaders must operate with the understanding that the more knowledge we harvest from all ends of our organizations, the more inclusion we generate. And the more inclusion we can build, the more likely we are to solve our problems. Even more so, the solutions to our problems are far more likely to endure when we support them with inclusion. Inclusion should not be dismissed as just another feel-good movement, urging us to share power and control simply for the sake of being fair to one another. It has the power to change the world. Inclusion is what will give successful companies and countries an advantage as they work to grow and then sustain power in a hyper-competitive, information-supercharged environment. In this sense, inclusion is the way of the future. Chapter 14, Radical Inclusion. The general and the guru set out to write a leadership book, but they discovered something much more profound. They learned, amplified, and brought clarity to the reality that our sense of belonging has changed, that the more technology connects us, the further we grow apart, and the more we highlight our differences and ignore our similarities. Under the influence of digital echoes, we are becoming more isolated, more suspicious, less positive, and less optimistic. This is affecting the way we interact with one another in government, in the workplace, domestically, and globally. 100 years ago, in the second decade of the 20th century, the world went to war. In 1919, writing about the aftermath of World War I in Europe and about the Irish War of Independence with Great Britain, poet William Butler Yeats expressed the anxiety of the times in a poem he titled The Second Coming. He used Christian imagery of the apocalypse and Second Coming allegorically to describe the collapse of innocence, of order, of restraint, of compassion, and ultimately of civilization. He mused about what would take its place. The ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Now I know that 20 centuries of sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, and what rough beast. Its hour come round at last. slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. We wonder what poets will write of our time. This is a book of leadership principles, but it also asserts that in the era of digital echoes, post-truth, rapid change, intense scrutiny, and supercharged emotion, well-meaning men and women, all of us, must think differently, radically, about inclusion. Radical inclusion to counter inequities, intolerances, biases, and manipulations, the things that erode trust and render leadership ineffective. Radical inclusion to promote integrity, empathy, collaboration, ownership, and accountability, the things that build trust and make leadership effective. The general and the guru are indeed pragmatic, but we're also worried. History doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. Conclusion. For those who aspire to lead, the future is rich with opportunity. Issues will continue to become more complex, mutate more rapidly, and draw more scrutiny. Technology will provide more data and more accessibility. Leading will be exciting, and it will be dynamic. Great leadership will be even more important than it is today, and it's obviously crucial today. It will also be harder. Harder in an environment that can produce paralyzing choices, ubiquitous distractions, and dramatic polarization. Harder because of the corresponding increase in suspicion, disappointment, anger, and skepticism. The things that allow people to become more informed and more connected, to organize their lives, to work from home, and to develop global social networks are the same things that allow them to choose what they want to know, to block out what they do not, to avoid personal contact, and to be recruited for causes good and bad. We don't know how much more difficult leading will become, but we know for sure that it will become more difficult. We know for sure that it will take more of everything. More attention, more learning, more effort, and more inclusion. It's been said that certain things are best seen with peripheral vision. The idea is that too much clarity, too much focus, and too much definition can obscure the richness, depth, and complexity of some subjects. The things that make men and women effective leaders fall into that category. In radical inclusion, we have proffered several leadership principles and expressed our conviction about several leadership instincts. We suggest that the application of any one of them will improve a leader's relationship with his or her followers, but we concede that even adherence to all of them will not guarantee a leader's success. On the other hand, we strongly believe that the environment we describe, including prominently the emergence of digital echoes, require leaders to recognize, understand, and commit to inclusion as a leadership imperative. Here's our bottom line. Inclusion is harder and can be slower, but it is a necessary precondition for achieving effective, efficient, and enduring solutions to complex problems. Yes, inclusion can positively affect fairness and equality in the workplace, which yields greater trust between leader and follower, but more importantly, it's about persistent learning, shared ownership of decisions, and deeper commitment to the implementation of those decisions. It's about developing trust by listening, amplifying, and including. It's not a silver bullet, but it is an accelerator of the best ideas and a brake against the worst ideas. Radical inclusion acknowledges complexity and seeks to mitigate the risks inherent in the era of digital echoes. Failure to recognize and adapt to this new reality, failure to deeply embrace inclusion, would be the defining leadership failure of the 21st century.
Acknowledgements. If we've learned anything from the experience of writing this book, It's that assembling a team of smart, confident, dedicated people of diverse backgrounds, willing to challenge one another's thinking, produces the best results. We deeply appreciate Tom Rath for his insights and experience. P.O. Yeskovitz, our publisher, for his passion and drive. John Hutchinson for helping us discover the digital echo. Chip Colbert for helping us bridge the military and business worlds. Rachel Vick for her careful research and her patient management of two people who aren't easily managed. San Yen Sheng for her confidence in us and for helping us draw out our common insights about leadership. Mary Sampson for her unfailing attention to detail. Ruth Schenkel for sharing her ideas about listening and amplifying voices. Hillary Roberts for her brilliance and clarity with our modest prose. Paul Petters for his meticulous proofreading. And Punch Audio for helping us broaden our reach through audio.
We hope you've enjoyed Radical Inclusion, written by General Martin Dempsey and Ori Braffman. Narrated by Alex Hyde-White, with dedications from the authors. Executive Producer P.O. Yeskovitz of Mission Day Press. Produced by Punch Audio. Copyright 2018 by Mission Day Press. Production copyright 2018 by Mission Day Press. Produced by Punch Audio. Recording engineered by Samir Besairevic at the world-famous Studio 9, Hollywood. Punch Audio creates first-class audiobooks for independent authors the world over. Please see us online at punchandroll.com and on Facebook at Punch Audio. Learn more about Martin Dempsey and Ori Braffman's work on Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.